Hi, I'm Steve Clements, and I have a question. If the Iran nuclear deal isn't close to a done deal, are Iran and the United States back on a collision course to war? Let's get to the bottom line. After a tough year of negotiations, Iran and the United States seem to be this close to restoring the historic nuclear deal they signed in 2015. That deal was torn up by former President Donald Trump, who replaced it with a policy of maximum pressure on the Iranian government for years. But shortly after winning the 2020 election, the administration of President Joe Biden said the maximum pressure policy had failed, and the United States was ready to lift sanctions on Iran in return for limits to the Iran nuclear program. But the devil's in the details, and now both sides accuse each other of blocking progress in talks in Vienna, Austria. So where do things stand, and what's at stake? Today we're talking with Roxanne Farman-Farmayan, who teaches international politics of the Middle East and North Africa at the University of Cambridge, and Trita Parsi, the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. Trita, let me start with you. Where are these talks stuck right now, and were they actually close to getting a real deal?
They were, without a doubt, close, and we are still very, very close. But there's some details that are remaining. For one thing, the Europeans are completely done with their elements of the deal, and the last things that are remaining are a few sanctions issues and the issue of whether the IRGC will remain on one of the U.S.'s terrorist listings, a demand that the Iranians have made. They had done it earlier before. But the reason why it's become such a problem right now is that it's become public. Once it was leaked, both sides found themselves in an impossible position because now it's really difficult for both of them to compromise, which is probably the intent behind those who leaked this information.
Well, I would ask you just to go one step further because I think, you know, trying to understand the politics of Iran and look in the political situation in the United States, this deal, if it were to come about, has to stand the test of the light of day. You know, you have to have at least enough consensus. Maybe consensus is the wrong word, but at least a majority view that it's a healthy, that's a resilient deal to get through. And as I understand it, this IRGC, Foreign Terrorist Organization designation, is a holdup on the Iranian side. Are there other elements of the deal that are keeping it from moving forward?
It really is it. I mean, there's some minor sanctions issues beyond that, but the U.S. side is actually done with its request of what it wants from the Iranians. This is the last thing remaining. It's a request, of course, from the Iranian side. I think you're absolutely correct that under normal circumstances, there needs to be enough confidence in a deal and make sure that there's enough support on both sides for its longevity to be able to be strong. But we have to be quite honest that under these circumstances, with or without this IRGC delisting issue, reality is that neither side has high hopes that this deal will survive the Biden administration because of the political instability on the U.S. side, in which numerous high-profile Republicans have already made clear they're going to rip this deal apart if they take the White House in 2025, just as Trump did in 2016.
Dr. Roxanne Farman-Farmayan, you and I have discussed this issue before. I feel like we're going round the circle again to, you know, to be here when we discuss prospects for a potential deal. I guess my question to you is, how do you see things right now and where they're stuck? And again, coming back to that political question, how I'm more familiar with Washington where I sit right now, but how do we avoid a circumstance where we just simply go through flip-flop? Maybe not just in White Houses, but we're around the corner from an election in the United States, and doing a deal may, in fact, become, Trita Parsi knows as well, he worked in the U.S. House of Representatives. The U.S. House of Representatives, if it goes Republican, may very well become a torturous place for those people who put forward this new Iran nuclear deal. Roxanne?
Well, I think one of the things that we hear often is that we've never been closer to a deal coming together, and we've also never been further away, because the things that have to be resolved have been the problems right from the beginning. Many of the other things were, in some ways, the easier ones, and now we've gotten down to the most difficult. Hmm. And as Trita says, they've become public, which makes it considerably more difficult. If you think back on the 2015 deal, most of what was negotiated then was completely behind doors until the whole deal was put forward to the public. So this one has been all the way along, much more on the front burner. There have been issues that have been brought up all the way through, which is what has given it much of the political impetus that has caused this ability of the Republicans on the one side, and many Democrats also who are not at all sure they support this deal, to express strong doubts and plans for how to handle it when it is signed, if and when it's signed. And I think that likewise, one of the issues is that Iran has a lot at stake now. The deal was something unknown at the time that it was signed in 2015. By the time that it was stopped in 2018 by Donald Trump, it was clearer to the Iranians what the failures were of this deal. And so they're much less willing to step back from that. And monitoring the sanctions, for example, that they really get lifted, something like that has been an issue. And then certainly the element of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC, which has become, in a sense, a football going back and forth and is highly politicized, as well as being picked up very much by Israel, which is a major player in how this is all being negotiated on the global scene.
Thank you. Trita, you know, mid-March, there was the rumor, and I don't know if it was real or not, you might, that the United States was going to try to move to delist the IRGC from that foreign terror operators list sponsors a foreign terror list. And I guess my question to you is, you know, you remember when the first Iran nuclear deal was being negotiated. You had Secretary John Kerry, you had Secretary Ernie Moniz, you had Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman. You had people that felt like there was an enormous gravitas and energy around it. President Obama himself knew every fine detail of this deal, went out, talked to the American public. I don't get that sense of like high church, high school, power players encircling the Iran deal to kind of carry the ball forward. Has this been relegated to a lower level of priority, or was that part of the strategy all along?
It was part of the strategy, and you're absolutely right. This is a completely different approach compared to what the Obama administration pursued. I mean, this was high priority, number one priority, had the president's own strong involvement from the very, very outset. This does not have that. From the very beginning, the Biden administration did not treat this as a high priority. And to a certain extent, understandably, they came in and they saw a tremendous amount of domestic crisis that they had to attend to. And there was a political argument within the White House that nothing on the foreign policy front should be allowed to jeopardize Biden's domestic agenda. And that legacy has still then lived on. This is part of the reason why the Biden administration didn't do what would have been much easier, not easy, but much easier, and I think far more effective, which is to just go back into the deal through an executive order and then resolve all of these thorny issues from inside the deal, while the Iranians, as a result of the U.S. returning to the deal, would have seized a lot of their nuclear activities, and they certainly would not have been able to expand the things that they have done right now. So, for instance, part of the challenge the administration is faced with right now is that the Iranian breakout capability, which is the time it takes for them to make a decision to build a bomb and then to have the ready material for the bomb, it was at 12 months as long as the deal was in place. It's now shrunk to mere weeks as a result of most of the activities the Iranians have engaged in since Biden came into office, such as enrichment at 60%. It simply did not exist prior to Biden's presidency. And had he gone back into the deal from the very beginning, yes, there would have been a political cost. It would have been somewhat challenging, and certainly some thorny issues such as IRGC would still have been difficult to resolve. But most of the very, very problematic things that the Biden administration is faced with right now, including a much higher political cost to get this through Congress, would have been avoided.
Roxanne, what Trita just said is extraordinary. I mean, what he basically just said, in my words, is that Iran is an undeclared nuclear weapons power today. Some years ago, and I think Trita was at this dinner, I had was participating in dinner with former Iranian President Khatami, who told us that we were fools because Iran at that moment, when he was there, would have frozen reprocessing at a non-industrial level, at a research level, and brought the, you know, the centrifuges down there, that we would have had Iran in a sort of slight R&D level, you know, in perpetuity, and that every time we have, you know, changed the game or moved the goalposts, Iran has come up and been unwilling to kind of do back. I'd love to get your sense, if you have any real, I don't know why Iran, if it is as close that Trita just said, why it would ever give up its nuclear program now.
Well, it's a very good point that you make. I wouldn't say it is a nuclear weapons power yet, and I wouldn't even put it on the same level as Japan, which has turnkey capacity, which Iran, as far as we know, does not. And one of the reasons is because the whole driver for Iran really has been to use the nuclear program as leverage. It has wanted to rejoin the international community. It wants sanctions lifted. This goes back 40 years to the time of the hostage crisis, that it has been trying to assimilate itself back in the international. And so one of the best tools to do that has been the nuclear program. Certainly, this is not a moment, as we see the war in Ukraine and we're seeing what's happening with North Korea, that this is a time for any country that has an option for nuclear weaponry to sit back and easily give it up. These are very difficult times we're in. But it is not a nuclear power yet, even though the possibility of becoming one has certainly become, as Trita says, a matter of weeks. That means that it has enough weapons-grade capacity to build a weapon, but it has not done so yet.
Mm. Well, Roxanne, I want to ask you one other question here, and I'm not sure I'm going to get it out right, but and Trita, your view too. But I sort of wonder if America and the West have created a real problem in what I would call our own nuclear snobbery. I remember an ambassador of Turkmenistan in the mid-1990s coming and, you know, giving an organization I was helping to run a very big portrait. And I said, you can't give that to us. He says, no, you have to take it because you're the only ones in Washington who talk to us since we gave up our nuclear weapons. Without nuclear weapons, we have no status in Washington, D.C. We can't meet anyone. Now you see Russia, we have NATO and Russia in tents, but we're watched being very careful of red lines, not wanting to see a nuclear escalation in Russia. Ukraine, which gave up a nuclear weapons program, is seeing the horrors, you know, deployed against it by an invading nation over sovereign territorial lines. You saw in Libya giving up a nuclear program as well, and we saw what happened in that nation. So I guess, are all of these lessons in history that we're seeing unfold not something Iran is noticing when it worries, when you know, its domestic security is one of the driving forces of the perception of legitimacy of its own government? So I guess, I mean, if I were advising the Iranian government, I might say, why give up nuclear weapons if you see some of the other things that are going on out there? Roxanne?
Well, it's a dangerous neighborhood, as we all like to say, and I think that it's a bit more difficult to be Iran and have nuclear weapons than one might think, because certainly the growing standoff, aggression, shadow war that we're seeing between Israel and Iran is a problem, and Israel has made it very clear it will not accept that Iran has any kind of nuclear weapon, and we're seeing, in a sense, an introduction to that kind of approach, even now, with a great deal of exchange of attacks, of drone destruction, of many elements that have been going on this last year and a half that have really shown that Israel will not allow Iran to take that step. Likewise, it's quite difficult within the arena of multiple wars, such as we have in that region, to have a country now take on the actual development of nuclear weapons and view that as something that will add a degree of security, because in some ways it will only contribute to insecurity in the region.
Trita, what is your sense of that? And are we creating a culture where having nuclear weapons gets respect and security? Now, of course, that same rationale could apply to Saudi Arabia, could apply to other countries in the region, that once you proliferate in one or allow the proliferation in one, it's hard to imagine that calculus not being the same elsewhere in the region. And so we end up in a reactive situation, rather one proactively, where nuclear nonproliferation regimes are maintained. But what's your sense of how we've contributed to an environment that I think it would be very hard to give up that nuclear potential if one had it?
I think, unfortunately, you are quite right. There is an incentive structure that has been created in which, if not having the bomb, nevertheless, moving towards it provides you with leverage. I think we should also keep in mind, however, the United States has been quite forceful in making sure that the cost of pursuing the path that North Korea and Iran has been on is a tremendously costly one. And that, I think, is also a very strong signal to other countries in terms of a deterrence, not to think that this ultimately will really pay off. What I'm quite worried about is that the Iranians, for a very long time, I do not think actually had plans for a weapon. I think Roxanne is absolutely right. It was a leverage. It was a way of getting out of the containment that the United States had imposed on Iran since 1979, which, again, was largely because of Iran's own very radical and destabilizing activities. But nevertheless, the plan was never, I think, to actually go for a bomb. What I'm fearful right now is that the internal debate in Iran may be changing, not only because of Ukraine, but also because of the fact of a stronger perception on the Iranian side that these sanctions that have been imposed on Iran are going to be there more or less permanently, because of the very strong Republican opposition to any kind of arrangement with Iran. So even if Iran agrees to get rid of big parts of its program, ship out 98% of its low enriched uranium stockpile, if it's still going to be under some form of a sanction, because every time a Republican takes the White House, those sanctions are going to get snapped back, at some point the Iranians are going to say, if we're already paying the price for having a bomb while we don't have one, we might as well get one, and perhaps that will change the situation. That's the problem with sanctions in terms of if there isn't a clear and reliable path to get rid of them, the other side and the sanctioned country may start concluding that the only way to get rid of them is to escalate further. And in the case of Iran, that would be to either move towards a bomb or move very, very close to it. And that would be a very bad situation, in my view.
You know, Roxanne, I think the neighborhood, as you've mentioned before, is complicated. There are a lot of instabilities. You've got Yemen, the Houthis. We've got now a two-month hiatus, I suppose, a ceasefire that you know, possibly, you know, with the Saudis could, you know, create an opportunity to do some negotiating there. But part of this puzzle is that the UAE, the Saudi Arabia, and Israel, which have legitimate security concerns in the region, have been long concerned about Iran's nuclear program. They recently met Secretary of State Antony Blinken. And I'm just interested in, as you look at the signals from your perch, do you see any way or what kinds of concessions might bring an Israel, a UAE, and Saudi Arabia into alignment with the Biden administration on the possibility of this deal moving forward? Or do they become a kind of permanent veto?
Well, I think that, first of all, that growing alliance is very important. Those three, along with Egypt, there was also a recent meeting, are very much of the view that they should be putting together an alliance that is partially directed at containing Iran. And it is very much something that I think we're seeing is engaging in the exchange of quite high-level ammunitions and technology and surveillance, and we're seeing that happen at quite a pace. And I also agree with you very much that I think one of the problems that they see is that once Iran might get a bomb, that there would then be a rush for many of the states in that region to get a nuclear program up and running as well. So a very rapid escalation in that area. So I think that itself is something that the Saudi, UAE, Israeli coalition, in a sense, would like to have control over, as that direction seems to be the one that we're seeing pursued. And I think that there's also a sense that right at the moment, Iran is also having real difficulty containing the groups that it so far has had quite a bit of control over, is having real difficulty in terms of the politics going on in Iraq at the moment. Mm-hmm. It is running into quite a bit of friction with the Syrian establishment as well. It has certainly got not very much leverage in Lebanon, which is so fragile that, in a sense, everybody's keeping hands off there at the moment in case a war breaks out almost by default. So in many ways, we're seeing that some of the excessive leverage that Iran has had through its militias and its various Shia crescent extension is, in a way, right at the moment, becoming a little bit more fragile or compromised. And so we're also seeing that that is playing a role at the moment into how far it can be pressed in, as we go all the way full circle back to the negotiations with the JCPOA. All of these elements are reflecting that particular balance and how other states in the region are viewing it.
I remember that before the first JCPOA was struck, the first Iran deal was struck, President Obama said unambiguously, we have a choice. We either try to basically freeze and stop, Iran's move to a certain kind of, nuclear possible capacity down the road, or we're going to be at war. And when he said that we're going to be at war, we're going to have that conflict, that collision at some point, was very much part of the argument for why the JCPOA came in. So I guess my question to you is, if this deal isn't done, does President Obama's equation come back into effect? And where does restraint fit when it comes into the potential for Iran, which is not exactly a buddy of ours in the world, were to get a nuclear weapon? Would that then justify a preemptive strike to try to stop that or a military incursion of some kind?
I think that's an excellent question, Stephen. I would start off by saying that I do believe that if there is no deal, the most likely scenario remains some form of escalation towards a war. But I do think the situation is very different from 2012, where I think Obama genuinely believed that if there wasn't a deal, he would be more or less forced to go to war. Today, we have a very different situation internally in the United States. It is quite remarkable how strong the anti-war sentiments are amongst the American public. Just take a look at the recent polls done by Brookings in terms of American attitudes towards the war in Ukraine, a war in which the overwhelming majority of the American public believe is the fault of Russia, and they believe that the Ukrainians are absolutely right. Still, more than 65% do not want to see any U.S. military involvement in that war beyond simply providing arms and some training. But the red line is American lives. This is a very different situation compared to just 10 years ago. And I think that is imposing a significant restraint on Biden, on Iran, as well as on Ukraine. I mean, I think we would have seen a rather different posture 15 years ago if that war had taken place then. But so when it comes to the Iran situation, I don't think it's going to be the same type of automatic escalation. What I do fear, however, is that both sides are going to take some escalatory steps, and that's going to get them into an escalatory cycle in which they will likely end up in some form of military confrontation, even though neither side had the intent of getting to that point.
Right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Fascinating, important, consequential conversation with both of you. Political scientist Roxanne Farman-Farmayan and Trita Parsi, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what's the bottom line? Any deal between the U.S. and Iran has its enemies. For the record, the U.S. regularly certified that Iran was living up to its treaty obligations, but President Trump wanted America to exit the deal no matter what. Israel and the Gulf countries, well, they fear a resurgent Iran in the region. They prefer Iran to be in a defensive position, not one where it can normalize. And on the Iranian side, let's face it, some parts of the Iranian system thrive from tension with the West, even as their ordinary Iranian citizens suffer. And then there's the problem of what's the point of signing a deal with America, only to have it torn up every time the administration changes in the White House. That is the knot we're stuck with on the Iran deal, and my guess is we're going to be stuck there a really long time. And that's the bottom line.